Tonight, we turn our attentions to the fifth psalm. The fifth psalm, page 553, if you're using one of our pew Bibles. You see, the reality of our lives, which was also the reason that I chose to begin in 1 Peter and Andrew so perfectly without any knowledge of that, brought in that beautiful hymn to follow up. But the reality of our lives is that they're really a series of contrasting conditions. One minute things are going great, and the next minute everything's upside down and we feel like the wheels are coming off the cart. One minute everything's great, and then tragedy strikes. And we can vacillate between these two in either direction. We hope to spend more time in the joyful column than in the lamentation column, but sometimes we simply don't know. One of my favorite pre-salvation theologians, wait for it, Jimmy Buffett, used to say, tragedies better become comedies in a big hurry, or else you're in a whole lot of trouble. Now, although there may be some truth tucked in there somewhere, it focuses on a man-centered response. And that's usually what most of our world tells us. We can take the John Wayne theology that we just need to grab ourselves by the bootstraps and get moving. But that's not often an approach that's functional. Because the problem with these are that what if I'm in too much of a stupor to get myself out? What if I have just gotten to such a dark place that I can no longer see the light? Well, if I'm relying on myself, then I may indeed be in a whole lot of trouble. So what do we do? How do we address these varying conditions in our lives? Does Scripture talk about them? Or does it simply expect that we ought always be running at about a 9.5 or 10 in the joy and delight column? No, I don't think that that's at all what God expects, because He knows that's not the reality of our existence. And instead, He tells us how to address these varying conditions in our lives. And that's exactly what we see in Psalm 5. Because of this, I've titled our message, Contrasting Realities. Contrasting Realities. I think this will be a wonderful text to set our hearts and minds in preparation to celebrate the Lord's table tonight. Let's take a look at Psalm 5 and read it together, and then we'll expand on some of the particulars. Follow along with me, if you would, beginning in verse 1 of Psalm 5. Give ear to my words, O Lord. Consider my groaning. Heed the sound of my cry for help, my King and my God. For to you I pray. In the morning, O Lord, you will hear my voice. In the morning, I will order my prayer to you and eagerly watch. For you are not a God who takes pleasure in wickedness. No evil dwells with you. The boastful shall not stand before your eyes. You hate all who do iniquity. You destroy those who speak falsehood. The Lord abhors the man of bloodshed and deceit. But as for me, by your abundant loving kindness, I will enter your house. At your holy temple, I will bow in reverence for you. O Lord, lead me in your righteousness because of my foes. Make your way straight before me. There is nothing reliable in what they say. Their inward part is destruction itself. Their throat is an open grave. They flatter with their tongue. Hold them guilty, O God. By their own devices, let them fall. In the multitude of their transgressions, thrust them out, for they are rebellious against you. But let all who take refuge in you be glad. Let them ever sing for joy. And may you shelter them, that those who love your name may exult in you. For it is you who blesses the righteous man, O Lord. You surround him with favor as with a shield. Contrasting realities. Our psalm is a Davidic psalm. as are many of the Psalms within the Scripture, and nearly almost all of the Psalms in the first book of the Scripture. You realize that in the book of Psalms, that 150 Psalms is broken up into five different books. The first book encompasses chapter 1 to 41. And there only are about four of those 41 Psalms that are not Davidic in authorship or expressed as such. And as we know from our study of Hebrews, even one of those that is not expressed as Davidic, the author of Hebrews tell us, was written by David. So we see David carrying forward the vast majority of this first section of the Psalms, and also is the author of our psalm, as we see in the postscript there, which tells us, for the choir director, for the flute accompaniment, a psalm of David. So as we consider these contrasting realities, we come to the first contrast, which is our first point, and it is the contrast of wills in the first three verses. The contrast of wills. The question of contrast here is, whose will are we considering? In verse 1, David is looking only at his situation. But it's clear that he is in a very bad spot. We don't know what the circumstances are. In some psalms, we are given background and we're told that this is David as he's being attacked by Absalom, or told some other detail about it. But here we're not. But what we do know, as we see, is clearly things are not going well. This is not a warm and fuzzy moment for David. This is definitely one of the moments of tragedy in his life. And we see that from what he is doing in verse 1. He is commanding God to hear. Give ear to my words, O Lord, an imperative verb confirming the command that David is issuing to the Lord. He furthers that in the second stanza as he again commands him, consider my groaning. That is this condition of his groaning that ought consume God's attentions. And we can be that way too when things are difficult in our lives. We could command that God ought certainly be paying attention to us, for our issues are at least as significant as anyone else's. Verse 2 becomes more of the same. Another command to God, this one to heed the sound of his crying. Here, the word heed means to respond. Do something about this, Lord. You are the one that is in charge. David is clearly focusing in the first part of this contrast of wills on his own circumstances. He is the one that is the main issue. We may say that David almost appears here to be having a pity party. Ever had one of those? I have. And it's one thing. It's sin. It's us exalting ourselves and our own wills. And that's exactly what David is doing in this condition. Then in verse 3, we see the contrast of the wills. Now his view changes. And that change is signaled by the time of day. Notice it there as he says, in the morning. Isn't it wonderful to know the new perspective the Lord brings us in the morning? We just saw the prayer of the morning that was brought forward for us in Psalm 3 a few weeks ago. And there is something about the morning. There is a freshness about the morning. There is a newness of the day. That whatever the previous day held, I have a new start today. And this signals to us that this also was David's heart, that there was a change, that there is a new perspective that has arisen. And he says at the first stanza of verse 3, in the morning, O Lord, you will hear my voice. Literally, the Hebrew there reads, in the morning, O Lord, may you hear my voice. It almost sounds like a command in a future tense, the way it is written in the New American Standard. But really, it is a conditional statement. May you hear? There's a complete change in his attitude. And he recognizing that it is not his will that is going to govern the day. No, not at all. Now this conditional request instead of a command. The second half of the verse is likewise a complete change. Again, beginning with this new perspective on time. In the morning, I will order my prayer to you and eagerly watch. Isn't that an absolute 180 degree turn from what we just saw him proclaiming in verses 1 to 2? He's no longer commanding that God would hear. He is no longer commanding that God would consider, that God would heed. No, not at all. But he says, in the morning, I will order my prayer. I will arrange. He's saying that at the beginning of the morning, he is going to refocus his whole day, and it is going to begin with prayer to God. We wonder with where this idea of prayer first thing in the morning comes from. Was that some pastor's idea way back? Was that E.M. Bounds and his wonderful works on prayer? Was it Hudson Taylor and his spiritual secret as he went out into the China Inland Mission in the late 1800s and prayed 3 to 4 hours every day? Is that where the idea of morning prayer came? No. David had an idea that this is where it should begin. Because what does it do? It arranges us to eagerly watch for God. You know, it's wonderful when each morning when we wake up and when we pray that we take opportunity to pray for opportunities to share the gospel. Because then throughout the day, we are watching for those opportunities. We are watching for those coworkers. We are watching for others in the building where we are. We're watching for those in the market. We're watching for our neighbors. You know, I know Bill next door. I've been living next to Bill for 15 years. And I know he says he goes to that Lutheran church, but he's barely a Christmas and Easter Christian. I don't think Bill knows the Lord. I want to have a chance to witness to Bill. Lord, would today be the day? Would you allow me to witness to my neighbor? To share Christ, to let him know the love, and to openly proclaim all that you have done. See that eagerness, this eager watching. When our prayers are full, this is the importance of taking some serious time for prayer in the morning, because then we can understand all that God is doing. Prayer doesn't change God. Prayer changes us, helps our will align with his. As we wake up in the morning and we pray, I love praying for you all. I love our new book of corporate worship. Because I go through and I pray for each of you and I just wait to see what's going to happen. Think about what God is going to do in your life that day. I may not hear, but I will eventually. And I've got you all written on that back page so that I know what's going on. And when it changes, I write down that date. I say, what a praise it is to know all that God is doing and going to continue to do. So we see in this introductory section that there is this change in the will. And the question is, which will do you suppose is the most useful to rely upon? In a world of contrasting realities, in a world of ebb and flow, in a world of darkness and wickedness, which of these two wills ought we rely on? Well, it's quite clear. We must rely upon the will of God and not seek our own will. For it is his that will bring forth the greatest joy and peace for us. Because then we are not expecting, then we are not insisting. And we are knowing and we are aligning ourselves with God. The contrast of realities is first conveyed by a contrast of wills. And our second point in the next verses is the contrast of worship. The contrast of worship in verses 4 to 7. The first form of worship shown is that which is contrary to God. It is that which is wicked in verse 4. Verse 4, the first stanza says, for you are not a God who takes pleasure in wickedness. God is not a God who delights in the work of the wicked. No, he abhors it. He hates it. He goes on and says, no evil dwells with you. That means he does not abide in, he does not dwell, he does not live around evil. That is why God cannot tolerate sin. Because no evil can dwell with him. He will not put himself in that environment. And people say, well, but hasn't he been around Satan? Of course he has. But go and read Job 1 and see what happens when it speaks about Satan. He enters for a time and is then questioned by the Lord. But that brings up another interesting point, that the Lord also will use that darkness as he did in Job 1. Not always to our understanding or our recognition, but he does not ask for our understanding. He asks for our obedience and our humility as we come alongside him. That which is wicked in verse 4 is contrary to God. It is a worship that is contrary to him. In verses 5 to 6, the wicked worship continues. It says, the boastful shall not stand before your eyes. You hate all who do iniquity. You destroy those who speak falsehood. The Lord abhors the man of bloodshed and deceit. Those who worship themselves, those who worship their own devices and ways, God is absolutely antagonistic to, and they will not survive. Yes, it is those who are the murderers. Yes, it is those who are the liars. But it is even those who are boastful. They shall not stand before his eyes. How important is it for us to understand the downside of pride? We often speak of the wonderful proverb that pride comes before a fall and a haughty spirit before destruction from Proverbs. But how often do we recognize that it isn't just a fall that awaits us? But here, it is those who will not stand before God. Boastfulness and pride are a situation that will remove a person from before the presence of God. He hates those who do iniquity. He hates those who sin. He will destroy those who speak falsehood. How important is our tongue? We've recently been speaking in Hebrews about oaths. And about how God makes these oaths and how it tells us that he will not change his mind. Of course, we understand that so well about God. But it is not us that God is really communicating to, or it is not about himself that he is communicating. It is to us. And we are to be about that as well. We are to be those who are truthful. The words which we speak matter. There's a reason that Ephesians tells us that there is no, not some unwholesome words, but let no unwholesome word come from your mouth, but such that is good and is edifying for the hearer. We cannot have words that are lies, because those who do so worship contrary to God, and he will destroy them as he abhors the man of bloodshed and deceit. Stunning to recognize all of this. But then in verse 7, we have a change. We see the contrast of worship in verse 7, where it says, but as for me, by your abundant loving kindness, I will enter your house. At your holy temple, I will bow in reverence for you. I think this is one of the most gorgeous verses for us to understand. We think of coming to church, and you know, I often love to try to catch up with our younger families when they come to church in the morning, because I remember having little kids, and I know many of you do too. There was never a harder time to get to church, was there? The enemy was all over you. It was wonderful this morning. I was talking with one of our families, and they said last week they were trying to get to church. They, you know, there'd been a lot of things going on in their lives, and this was it. We were headed there, and what happens halfway here from home? The car blows up. And all of a sudden, there's smoke blowing out from underneath the hood. Well, I wonder how that happened. You think maybe there's somebody that's against our coming to church? Yeah, I think that we can have some enemies that are not too excited about us coming to church. You'll have to hear Karen's story sometime about her trying to get to the church in which a few months later I was actually saved at. It was only about a mile from our house, but the circumstances of the traffic and all of the details had her driving past the church three times to where she finally pulled over and cried out to the Lord, said, I am going to get to the church. The enemy is not going to stand against me. And as she got there so beautifully, she prayed in the parking lot that someone would welcome her. And one of her friends to this day came out on the stoop and embraced her and drew her in. And our lives have changed forever. Because we understand that our coming to church is not just our own intimation. It isn't our own initiative. It isn't our own effort. But as for me, by your abundant loving kindness, by your abundant steadfast love, by your overflowing hesed covenant love, do I come to church. I am here. I love to be here. There's nowhere else I'd rather be. I wish we were in church 7 days a week. Might be a little tough on the offering because I know some of you have jobs they expect you to show up at. But I still think it would be great. But it is because of the abundant love of God that we come. It is because of the abundant love of God that I am here. I could be just as pagan as everybody else and go watch that silly game tonight. Like, it's going to make a big difference, right? They're going to hear me yelling at the TV. My wife loves to watch me watch sports on TV. She thinks I'm part of the game. But I come by it naturally, a little bit of a rabbit trail, so I'll apologize. But I remember my dad one day watching a University of Montana football game. He is a huge Grizzly fan. And something went wrong in a play, and he literally tore both of the arms off the recliner. His wife looked at him and went, well, that was impressive. I'm sure that helped the team effort. Well, the idea that we understand that our desire, our delight to be in the house of the Lord comes from Him. We would not desire to be so otherwise. And as children, what a wonderful lesson this is for us to communicate to our kids, to our grandkids. Yeah, you may think, why am I going to church? I want to sleep in. I want to watch cartoons. I want to play video games. I want to have more cereal. The reason that we go is not because we want to be cruel taskmasters, but it's because God has blessed us with this abundant loving kindness. At your temple, I will bow in reverence for you. What a joy it is to come and pray in church, to pray along with whoever is leading our prayer, but to pray our own hearts, to pray the things, the secret things of our hearts that are only between us and God, and to recognize His amazing love, that He does hear us wherever we are, but it is a special time when we are together in the house of God. I love to sing. And I sing in my truck all the time. It's been the greatest week. I've had Christmas songs and Christmas carols on almost every day. It's been fabulous. But there is nothing like coming to sing with y'all. This morning was an amazing time of singing. Man, we were lit up. This place was humming. The choir just was on fire. The orchestra was ripping, and it was just a beautiful time. This is all because of the loving kindness of God. This is why we come in reverence, to delight with one another. We come, we enjoy the fellowship. It's because God placed that in us. Yes, we do love one another, and it is genuine, but it is also divine. Amazing to recognize the contrast of realities is second conveyed by the contrast of worship. Which worship do you think is most exalting to God? Which is going to best help us amidst the difficulties and struggles of our world? Clearly, it is the second. Understanding that it is God who leads us. It is God who gifts us to come. The contrast of wills, the contrast of worship, and our third point is the contrast of ways. The contrast of ways in verses 8 to 10. Verse 8 begins with the positive way. Oh Lord, lead me in your righteousness because of my foes. Make your way straight before me. This is the right way. We are to be led in the paths of righteousness. And to do so, even amidst our foes, even amidst those who lie in wait for us. To recognize that no matter the obstacle, we are to press ahead for righteousness. We are to press ahead for Christ. And to allow Him to saturate our lives in every way. That as we follow that path, it is that way of righteousness which must saturate all that we do. And that we are to indeed make our way straight or smooth reminds us exactly of what we see from Isaiah chapter 40, which is quoted in the New Testament regarding the arrival of Jesus and John the Baptist's proclamation. As John said that he would lower every high hill and raise up every valley to make the way of the Lord straight. So also is to be our way, straight before us, straight towards the focus of Christ. This straight is indicating for us the path which will not veer to the right nor to the left, where we will understand fully the way in which we are to walk and to live. The contrast of those ways is in verses 9 to 10, and the contrasting way is, of course, the wrong way. It says in verse 9, there's nothing reliable in what they say. Their inward part is destruction itself. Their throat is an open grave. They flatter with their tongue. Hold them guilty, O God, by their own devices. Let them fall. In the multitude of their transgressions, thrust them out, for they are rebellious against you. We don't know, as I mentioned earlier, what David was thinking of when this was going on. And we may read this and say, I can see that David was having a hard time, but it's hard for me to really associate with this. I know what you mean as we speak about having a straight way, having a way of righteousness. But what precludes our way of righteousness in verse 8 in that first stanza? It is our foes, isn't it? It is our enemies. And we think, well, David had some pretty serious enemies. He's got these guys who are unreliable in their speech, who are self-destructive inwardly, whose throats are an open grave, who flatter with their tongue, their speech over and over again wrong, that their devices are contrary to God, that they have a multitude of transgressions. And we think, but you know, I don't really have those kind of enemies in my life. I have a pretty easy life. I mean, we live here in the United States of America, in the greatest country on this earth, in the greatest ease and in the greatest wealth. I don't recognize these. Well, what are our foes to our straight path? Might they be the world? Might they be the devil? Might they be our very own flesh? Let's consider those three and place them in verses 9 to 10. There is nothing reliable in what they say. Let's put our flesh in there. There is nothing reliable in what my flesh says to me. Do you have things that ever come into your mind? Thoughts, words that you know are absolutely contrary to God? Nothing reliable in them. Their throat is an open grave. They flatter with their tongue. Oh, this is the way you should go. This is what you should have. These should be the things that are yours. You should have this and that. Have it your way, our Burger King mentality in our country. You deserve that. Just have it your way. Our world of commercialism has driven us to say that we deserve all these things. The entitlement mentality of our country is killing us because we believe that we deserve it all. But it is not only our country that is telling us this. At times we are telling it to ourselves. Is there ever an issue where we see the world as a hindrance to us? Do we ever become fearful about the things that we see about us? As there's a constant flux of Russia's nuclear war, China's nuclear war, Iran's nuclear war, North Korea's nuclear war, do we ever stop and pause and become fearful? Because there is this multitude of transgressions that are thrust out. The world that would seek to dethrone us, that would seek to take us away from God, have us focus on things other than Christ, keep us from the way of righteousness, keep us from the straight way. Oh, and how about our enemy and all that he would desire to do to move us off of the path? The one who is rebellious against you and who desires to take us down, who ever lives to accuse us night and day, as Revelation 12 tells us. And we can begin to believe those accusations. We can begin to believe that indeed we are not worthy, and we're not. But what we fail to recognize is that it is not us who is doing the work. It is God who is doing it. Just as it was God in our contrast of worship that gave us the joy of coming into his house, it is God who is guiding us through this life. It is God who has brought us salvation. It is not us. We cannot listen to these forces. We cannot allow these enemies every bit as powerful and perhaps more so because they are personal. They are us. And they know all that we are. And their way is contrary to the way of God. We must not follow this. We must recognize the attacks are every bit as dramatic that David faced as those we do. Are we not warned about the way that we ought go in Matthew 7:13-14? Does Jesus himself not say to us, enter through the narrow gate? For broad is the way that leads to destruction, and many there are who are on it. But narrow is the road that leads to life, and few there are who find that. We must understand that there is indeed a battle going on, and we are constantly being pulled off path. Our enemy, our own flesh, our world wants nothing more than to bring us down. Why do you think all of this stuff is going on? Why do you think when a conservative speaker shows up at one of our major East Coast universities, the walls come down, they start rioting, and there's fires and all of this crazy stuff? Maybe there's some forces contrary to righteousness going on in our world. I don't know, just a thought. We need to recognize the contrast of ways. We need to recognize the things that are keeping us off of that way. Because we must choose the right way, for in that we will be able to overcome the attack of the enemy. We will be able to overcome the loneliness and slothfulness, these times of depression. Because we will understand where our focus and contrast must be. That we must have a right contrast of wills focusing on God, a right contrast of worship, knowing that he draws us through that worship, and a right contrast of ways following the righteous and narrow path, and doing it all the time. It can't just be a Sunday. Throughout our week, throughout our day, beloved, if I could say moment by moment, there has never been a greater time. It is a scary time. It is a wonderful time, but it is a scary time. When we get to the end and the Lord's return, things get darker and darker all the way. It keeps spiraling. It requires more strength. It requires more trust in the Lord. It requires a greater embrace of one another and looking out for one another. That we would understand that we are our support staff, that we are the church, that we are the body whom God has individually placed you as members here for the functioning of this body. And that as we function, as we come together, we are unassailable. We are the church, and the gates of hell will not stand against us. And it is this joy and this resolution and this right view of contrast that take us to the conclusion in our last two verses. But let all who take refuge in you be glad. Let them ever sing for joy, and may you shelter them, that those who love your name may exult in you. For it is you who blesses the righteous man, O Lord. You surround him with favor as with a shield. This needs to be our call and our cry, that we would be those who are taking refuge in God, and because of it, being glad. That refuge doesn't mean that we will avoid the attacks of the world, of the flesh, of the enemy, but that we will take refuge and we will take solace in one another. We will take solace in the truth of God's word and in the everlasting way to stand on the shoulders of giants and continue to exalt Christ. To ever sing for joy. Have you ever tried to be bummed out when you were singing? It just doesn't happen. You know, there's a reason why when Saul was perplexed with an evil spirit from the Lord, David sang. David played the flute. And Saul's like, yeah, okay, I can get over this thing. Now when David stopped, of course, he's trying to pin him to the wall with spears. But we cannot be distraught. We cannot be unhappy when we are listening to music. What a gift it is for many who are struggling in life, particularly at the end of their lives. And I've heard so many stories, and I have participated in people who seem incommunicative in that hospital bed. And you start singing that old hymn, and boom, they're humming. You're like, you know, the family or the doctors, they've not made a sound in days. Yeah. Because it is the joy of song that God has placed in our heart. We don't worship to these songs because, oh, well, we just want to make sure we're the rigid traditionalists. No, these are the songs of doctrine. These are the songs of the faith. These are the songs of hope and joy. These are the songs that have meaning and power. That we can go home and we can study the lyrics without the song, and it will bring us an impact. You know, I had read that song this morning, Who is This King of Glory, by Third Day. I have sang that song. I've got it on probably three different CDs. I've read it three or four times before this morning's message. I couldn't hardly get through it. I was just choking up because it's so amazing to consider those words, because those words draw us to our King. Those are the joy of singing. And that we recognize that it is God's shelter who we're in, and it's His name that we exalt in. All of these things draw us to His name. Isn't it beautiful that there is a name, a book of names of God that is about 500 pages? Why did God give us so many names? Could He not just have been Yahweh? Perhaps. How rich is it that He has revealed so much about Himself in His names? We were praying this evening, talking about the national prayer breakfast that went on, and how this gentleman went forward and recounted all of these names of God for this national prayer breakfast, and how motivational that was. There was a Facebook post by our vice president that talked about how moving it was for them to consider the attributes and power of God brought forward in His name. In His name, we love because we exalt in them and in Him. And it is Him, it is our God who blesses the righteous one and who surrounds us with favor. Are we not surrounded with favor? Look around you. Go ahead, look around. You are surrounded with favor. The favor of God is all about you. It is the love of Christ. It is the gift that He has given. It is your brother and sister, those who are closer to you than many of your true brothers or sisters. And they share the love of Christ. And they want to encourage and exalt you in that. This is the shield about us. This is our glory and our delight. God has blessed us to understand that we have a choice in the way that we will choose our lives, in the contrast that exists, in the way that we will focus our will, in the understanding that we will have of our worship, and in the desire that we choose for the way that we will go. And when we rightly choose, we will have a joy and a glory and an exaltation that no one can trump. It is just a joy for us to know Christ in this way, to know one another, and to recognize his blessings.